Let's do some Shadal on Mishpatim. Yesterday, we talked about something very interesting, which was the concept that the Torah might say something that is not meant to be taken stringently. Now, Yosef had said it in an interesting way. He said it's not meant to be taken seriously. That's not how Shadal really puts it. He says that it was known that this was going to be handled by the judges. The judges had a Torah Shabbat path, I guess we can call it, or a tradition of how to handle these cases. It's on the books for some reason. It's in the Torah for the layman, the regular common person, to read that and be like, wow, the Torah's strict. And, you know, not in a bad way, like, oh, wow, why should I keep this? But rather, if I am not careful about my slave, about my bull, about my another person's life, then I have to deal with the consequences of that. So we saw yesterday, we kind of skipped a little bit, and we saw yesterday the case of someone who curses their parent, curses his father, his mother. He's put to death. So Shadal says, obviously, the judges are not putting a guy to death for cursing someone. How we would phrase it for Shadal is the law in the Torah is the ceiling, is the maximal type of punishment that the courts would have permission to hand out, but would not actually hand out such a punishment. Okay? Now, he says that by cursing, but he also says that on all the other ones, there's one guy who strikes a person and he dies. So there's discussion Shadal has about, and the Mefarshim in general have, of, is this premeditated? Is this manslaughter? What exactly is the case here? A man strikes another. This is Chaf Aleph Yud Bet. A man strikes another and he dies from that strike. He's put to death. So he says, in several other contexts, this expression, he will be put to death, is used. And there's no doubt, says Shadal, that the meaning is to be put to death by the court. Moti mat means put to death by the court. And by putting it into the context of court now, Shadal has the freedom to say, and the court can do whatever they want. They can decide how they want to do. It is unlikely, he says, that the judges would render such a judgment without testimony. So first of all, there's no mention of witnesses, the requirement for witnesses. There's no mention of whether it was intentional or by accident. There's no, nothing. And elsewhere it is specified that there must be, in fact, two witnesses. The rabbis added the requirement of hatra, meaning to give warning to witnesses, so as to distinguish between unintentional and intentional conduct. This, too, was for the sake of leniency. Okay, that's just another one. Where else? Actually, in the same pasuk previous, forgot to mention this, he says, according to the plain meaning, even if the striker did not intend to cause death when he unknowingly and intentionally struck, he's put to death if the victim dies of the beating. This matter may indeed be broken down into innumerable details, and the Torah leaves the judgment to the judges. There's so many details missing here. So he mentions later about what about witnesses? What about intentional versus unintentional? So many details about this are missing. The idea is that let's just tell you what the law is, and the judges will have the decisions about how exactly to apply that law. And they can be lenient. Now, all of this is really interesting, because again, we have to say that the Pshat in the Torah is not actually how the halacha went down, but it goes beyond just saying that there's a difference between Pshat in the Torah and Drash. He's saying that the Torah itself never meant for this to ever actually be applicable. Okay? That's one idea of the split of Pshat and Drash that I don't see in any other Mefarish. You don't really see that elsewhere. Here's another idea that is, maybe, perhaps you can consider it its counterpart, where instead of seeing Pshat as separate than Drash, they are separate, but they're both meant to apply. How does that make sense? Let's go for the pasuk of Chaf Aleph Chaf Gimel, which is eye for an eye. Eye for an eye. Shadal says, well, how do we understand that in Torah Shabbat? That was eye for an eye, ayin tachan ayin. Was that in reference to? Pay for his damage. You poke out someone's eye, you don't have to lose your own eye. And I think it's Rav Saadia Gaon, many others spend a long time trying to show how it's obvious that the Torah meant that all along. Meaning, even though it says eye for an eye, first of all, if you poke out someone's eye, and you're required to lose your eye, what if you're half blind? So losing an eye is only half the punishment, right? What if your eye is smaller than theirs? Or what if you only only hurt them a little bit? How do they measure exactly how much to damage you in your eye, right? It's impossible practically. The idea of eye for an eye, if it meant that you can do it on a monetary scale, that also has its own problems, like you're mentioning. And the Ran actually brings this up in Joshua the Ran, the famous one on Shoftim, on Parsha Shoftim, which is that the laws of the Torah that we see here in Mishpatim are woefully inadequate, says the Ran. It's pretty strong. I don't know if you puts it in that language, but it's comes out from his essay that it's missing so many details. You can't run an actual society if you just stay with the Torah law. Even Torah Shebaal Peh fills in a lot of that stuff, but it might not be enough. So let's say you have a guy who's fabulously rich. You have Jeff Bezos, and he decides that he just wants to chop off people's arms. He wants to go with a hatchet. And all he has to do, according to the Torah, and according to the Torah Shebaal Peh's interpretation of the Torah, all he has to do is what? Pay the money. That is obviously not. So the Ran comes up with a solution. He says that's the point of the king. The point of the king is to fill in the rest, to fill in the gaps. He says that the Torah is only religious law. It's to make you more spiritual. How Mishpatim exactly fits into that is a good question. However, the king is meant to fill in the rest and adjudicate according to the needs of the society and make more laws. So, for example, Jeff Bezos would go to jail by decree of the king. And the king can actually put people to death if he feels like it, even if there's no witnesses, even if they're whatever, which gives him tremendous power and also tremendous ability for abuse. But that's there's a balance of the judicial branch and the monarchical branch, I guess you would say. That's his solution. Shaddai has a different one. And again, this is a contrast, right? Because we have the idea that the pshat, we've seen before that the pshat can be upended by Chazal. We even saw 2 days ago how the pshat can actually be upended by the Torah Shebichtav. We saw what? That the slave goes free, if he wants to stay, he stays le'olam, he stays forever. And according to Chazal, the forever means till Yovel.
At most 50 years.
Right, exactly. At most 50 years, and it could be much less than that if he's bought and sold within a year of the Yovel. So that just indicates, says Shaddai, that originally there was one law, and then one book later in Leviticus there was a second law, and it undid the first law. So we have Torah Shebaal Peh doing that, we have Torah Shebichtav doing that. And here, this is a very interesting contrast, where the pshat and the halacha are actually two sides to the same coin. What does he say? He says, the relevant part here, this is one of the things that the Torah left to the judges, right? We've been talking about all these different things, left to the judges to decide how to actually adjudicate them. And the law is the ceiling. The law that you'll find in the Torah is the worst punishment you could possibly think of to hand out for that crime, maybe we would say. He says, indeed, if there would be a rich person who did not mind losing money and who took pleasure in injuring others, the judges would be able to impose the written penalty, which is eye for an eye. So he doesn't say that there's going to be a prison system, like maybe we would do. But he does say that what is the pshat of eye for an eye is still relevant. It's still applicable if the judges decided that would be a good preventative measure. That would, if everybody knew that the possibility was that if they poke out someone else's eye,
so that the voice, if they want to, can do that.
Exactly. Though the Torah writes things to give the permission to the judges, so that they can apply the pshat, even though in Drash, eye for an eye means money. Now, it's interesting. I think if you look at the Rambam says that this is an explanation that was given at Sinai. Like, the real Masorah is that eye for an eye never meant, never even in pshat means like an actual eye. I think if you look at the Rambam, that's the kind of language he has. However, here, Shaddai says, okay, there's two levels. There's the pshat and the drash, and they go hand in hand. It depends on the society. Shaddai does this elsewhere as well. But it is a very, very interesting possibility and Very cool. Okay. And one more. One more interesting comment. Again, we're finding all of these really fascinating methodological. How does Shadal understand the Pshat? How does he understand the Drash? And how are they interacting with each other in Mishpat? Okay? So one of the examples of this, which it's a strange thing in Chaf Aleph, Chaf Tes. It says that if there was a goring ox, that, you know, it's a muad, right? The owner had been warned of it and does not guard it and then causes a man or woman to die. The ox will be stoned and also the owner will be put to death. So this is hard to understand, right? You didn't watch your ox very well and it ended up killing somebody. You knew that it was an angry ox. It was a dangerous ox. And you didn't guard it well. You can be liable for the death penalty. So usually we put the death penalty on a very high level that you have to have intent and you have to it has to be direct. Like you have the Gemara and Sanhedrin talking about, let's say you leave a lion in front of somebody and it's like a question of whether, like, is it a starving lion or, you know, like there's questions that the Gemara has of how direct do you actually have to kill somebody with intent. Right? Oh, you're remembering some stuff from Sanhedrin. So yeah, what exactly is going on here that the owner will be put to death? So here's what he says. The plain meaning is that the court will put him to death, but the Torah permitted the taking of a ransom, which we're going to find in the next passage, since he did not kill the victim with his own hand. So the Torah says he should be put to death, but leaves an opening for leniency within the Torah itself. We're going to see that he has the option, according to Shadal, this is against most of the Mefarshim, against Chazal, because Shadal says no. The idea is that the judges have the right to decide how to deal with this guy. The Torah left it up to the judges to judge according to the nature of the person in the incident, whether he was worthy of death or worthy of being saved by a ransom, meaning he could pay off his the terrible deed that he did, what the amount of the ransom should be. However, the rabbi said that he was liable to be put to death by the hand of heaven, not by a human court, meaning when he pays, he would be put to death by heaven. Okay, so that's really interesting. What's the reason why the judge? What would be the reason why you would accept a the ransom? Why would the judges allow for that? So he says, this is interesting. The judges see that he's worthy of being saved from death. Maybe he's a really good guy. He just made a stupid choice by leaving his gate unlocked, with his muad on the his ox on the loose. What?
Negligent.
He was negligent. And they saw that this guy, he's very beneficial to society. He runs an orphanage or something. And even though he made this mistake, he should be able to pay the. It's a civil. Instead of it being a criminal case, it should be a civil case where the victim's families can sue him, basically. And or it's, maybe it's not as active as that, but the judges can award money to the family in order to recompense them for having lost these lives.
What does him being the owner of an orphanage have to do?
If he's a good guy, the judges can decide, I don't think this guy should be put to death. There's two options in the Torah, according to Shadal's reading.
If he's a bad guy, it makes a difference.
Yes. If it's a bad guy, why would the judges want to save him from death? Let him die. He's a bad guy. He's actually an evil guy who sends out oxen to kill people.
No. Let's say. If both of the cases are that he just accidentally left the gate.
Yeah. It could be different depending on if the judges want to save this guy. That's how Shadal. So that's a little tough, right? He says, well, how do you ransom your soul? That's how it puts it in Lamed, in Pasuk Lamed. It says, pidyon nafsho. A pidyon, a ransom for his soul. So how do you decide that? The judge is assessed according to his wealth. So if he's a very poor guy, it could be very little money. And on whether he was greatly or slightly negligent, it also depends on how bad he was actually negligent in this case. Right? That's another consideration. It does not appear likely that this is what Shadal says, that the phrase refers to the personal valuation of the guilty party or the victim. Okay, fine. He goes into that a little bit. Fine. What we see here, and what we saw yesterday, and like all of these come together, is like various ways that the pshat and the halacha, the giving over to the judges, plays out throughout the psukim in very different ways. And Shadal is able to pick up on these little hints in the psukim to understand. Also, it has to be logical, it has to make sense. Very fascinating stuff. That's where we'll end for today, the interaction between pshat and drash.